Chapter 3. I was on the brown plaid sofa watching TV and scotch taping my bangs to my forehead because Jeanette said that kept them from drying frizzy. Across the room on the Barca lounger, my mother was having her nervous breakdown. Ma sat hunched over one of our fold-out TV trays, working constantly on a religious jigsaw puzzle without making any progress. She wore her knee socks and her quilted pink bathrobe, despite the early summer heat. She ate nothing but cubes of Kraft caramels. For 2 weeks, I had been reaching over and turning up the volume, trying as best I could to ignore the private curse word she'd begun chuckling to herself, trying not to see the litter of caramel cellophane that was accumulating around her chair in a kind of half-circle. It wasn't that Ma hadn't put up a fight. In Daddy's absence, she'd repainted the downstairs hallway and exercised in front of the TV with Jack LaLanne, and cried and kicked the lawnmower until it eventually started. Her efforts at going it alone led her back to Sunday Mass, and through a succession of brief jobs, convalescent home cook, bank teller, Notions department clerk at Mr. Big's discount store. When winter cold burst one of our pipes, Ma called and called until she located the random Yellow Pages plumber who got out of bed to come fix it. But we'd done nothing about maintaining the pool the previous fall. Leaves had fluttered down onto the surface, then sunk and rotted. By springtime, the pool water was brown soup. One morning in May, Ma went downstairs and found Petey dead at the bottom of his cage. "Why me? Why always me?" She was still sobbing when I got home from school. She hadn't gone to work that day and didn't go the next day either. At the end of the week, Mr. Biggs called to say they were letting her go. By then, she'd already begun living in her robe. It was Ma's hair that finally got to me. At school, I sucked breath mints and carried a small bottle of Tussie deodorant in my purse for whenever I could get my hands on the lavatory pass. Ma's unwashed hair, matted and crazy, alarmed me enough to suspend the Cold War against my father and contact directory assistance in Tenafly, New Jersey. It had been almost a year since my father's move to Tenafly, where he'd opened a flower shop with his girlfriend, Donna. "Good afternoon, Garden of Eden," Donna said. I had spoken to her only once before, phoning the day my parents' divorce became final to call her a whore. The two prevailing mysteries in my life were what Donna looked like and why, exactly, my father had traded us for her. "May I speak to Tony?" I said icily. "This is his daughter, Miss Dolores Price." When my father got on, I cut through his nervous chit-chat. "It's Ma," I said. "She's acting funny." He coughed, paused, coughed again. "Funny how?" he asked. "You know, funny peculiar." Neither Donna nor I wished to live under the same roof. And neither the Nords nor my father would entertain my proposal that Jeanette and I live at our house for the summer, and Mrs. Nord drive over with our meals and clean laundry. It was decided I would move to my grandmother's house on Pierce Street in Easterly, Rhode Island, until Ma got right again. On the one-hour drive to Grandma Holland's, I clutched my notebook filled with addresses of girls from whom I'd forced promises to write me regularly. Daddy kept sneaking nervous peeks at me and at the rearview mirror. Behind us, the U-Haul trailer wobbled and swayed from side to side. In silence, I waited impatiently for the tragic highway accident that would paralyze me but wrench both my parents back to their senses. I pictured the three of us back home on Bobolink Drive, Daddy pushing my wheelchair solemnly up the front walk, eternally grateful for my forgiveness. At the doorway, Ma would smile sadly, her hair as clean and lustrous as a Breck shampoo girl's. Daddy didn't say much to Grandma. He deposited my bike and suitcases and cartons in the front foyer, kissed me on the forehead, and left. Grandma and I were cautiously polite to each other. "Make yourself at home, Dolores," she said hesitantly as she opened the door to what had once been my mother's bedroom. The room smelled dry and dusty. The windows were stuck closed, and there were little rows of insect carcasses along the sill. When I sat down on the hard mattress, it crackled under me. I tried to picture my mother in this room as a 12-year-old girl like me, but all I could see was Anne Frank on the cover of her paperback diary. With each trip up or down the front staircase, I watched the portrait of Eddie, my dead uncle. His blonde hair was pushed up into a spiky crew cut. His eyes peeked out from beneath two bushy brows and followed my steps with eerie cheerfulness. His smile was almost a smirk, as if he might reach out from the frame and jab me in the ribs as I passed. For supper we ate meatloaf and creamed spinach. The two of us sitting in a silence broken only by the occasional clink of fork against plate, or Grandma's clearing her throat. When she got up to make herself some tea, she addressed the stove. "She's not cuckoo, you know," she said. "He's the one with a mortal sin on his soul, not Bernice." That evening, I thumbtacked my Dr. Kildare collage to the wall and unpacked my clothes. Grandma had placed little sachet pillows in the dresser drawers. As I yanked each drawer open, the smell of old ladies from church, with their powdered wrinkly necks and quivery singing voices, drifted up toward me. In the bottom bureau drawer, I discovered a little red ink message hidden in a back corner, written right into the wood. "I love Bernice Holland," it said. "Sincerely, Alan Ladd." Twice during the night, I put the light on and got out of bed to make sure it was still there. Grandma turned her TV to thunderous volume and told me I mumbled. She was still an Edge of Night fan. Sometimes I'd grab a Coke from the refrigerator and slump down on the couch with her, slurping intentionally from the bottle. "I hope you don't sit like that in school," she said. "It's unladylike." I thumbed through the TV guide and reminded her I was on summer vacation. "When I was your age at the Bishop School, I received a medal for deportment on class day. A girl named Lucinda Coate thought she was going to get it, told me as much. She was a big piece of cheese, very stuck on herself. But no, they gave it to me. And here is my very own granddaughter who can't even sit correctly on a divan." "What's a divan?" I said, swigging my Coke. "A sofa," she said, exasperated. She watched in silent horror as I stuck my thumb over the Coke bottle opening and shook, then let the foam erupt into my mouth. "Can I turn the TV down?" I asked. "I'm not deaf, you know." Evenings after the dishes, Grandma hobbled around the house with her frayed prayer book, which was held together with rubber bands. Then she'd settle in front of the television to watch her westerns, Bonanza, Rawhide, while I sat out at the kitchen signing corny get-well cards to Ma, and pages of complaints to Jeanette. In our first week together, Grandma told me it was a sin the way I wasted hot water, toilet paper, my spare time. She said she'd never heard of a girl who had reached my age without learning to crochet. I retaliated by shocking her as best I could. At breakfast, I drowned my scrambled eggs in plugs of ketchup. evenings. I danced wildly by myself to my 45s, while she watched from the doorway. It was mostly for Grandma's benefit that I mouthed the declarations of the girl singers. My love is like a heat wave. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to. One night, Grandma wondered aloud why I didn't ever listen to singers who could carry a tune. Like who, for instance? I scoffed.
Well, like Perry Como.
That old dinosaur, I snorted.
Well, how about the Lennon sisters, then? They can't be much older than you.
I lied and told her one of her precious Lennon sisters, Diane, the oldest, her favorite, was having an illegitimate baby.
Pfft, she said,
flicking away the possibility with the flap of her wrist.
But her lip quivered, and she left my room, making the sign of the cross. Pierce Street smelled of car exhaust and frying food. Glass shattered, people screamed, kids threw rocks. Jeepers, Christmas, Grandma would mumble as cars squealed by at emergency speeds. She told me she had warned her husband, my grandfather, that they should follow the doctors and lawyers and school teachers who had moved out of the neighborhood after the war. But Grandpa had put it off and put it off, and then, in 1948, had died, leaving her with teenage children and a two-family home with a leaky roof. This house has been my cross to bear, she was fond of saying. She had come to see her staying on amongst the riffraff as the will of God. He had placed her here as a model of clean Catholic living. She was not obliged to speak to any of her neighbors, only to offer them her good example. At dusk each evening, Mrs. Tingley, Grandma's third-floor tenant, clip-clopped down the side steps with her bug-eyed chihuahua, Cutie Pie.
"Come on, Cutie Pie, go poopy," Mrs. Tingley always said, while the dog circled nervously on his tether.
In all the years Mr. and Mrs. Tingley had rented from my grandmother, Grandma had assumed he was the drinker, not her. But after Mr. Tingley's death, the package store man had kept pulling up to the curb as usual. My bedroom ceiling was Mrs. Tingley's bedroom floor. The only sound from above was the click of dog toenails, and I pictured Mrs. Tingley up there lying in bed, sipping in silence. Across from Grandma's was a tin-roofed store divided in two. One half was a barber shop. The barber, a thin, jowly man, sat sadly at the window most of the day, reading his own magazines and waiting for customers. The other half was the Peacock Tattoo Emporium. It was run by a skinny older woman with dyed black hair and red toreador pants. On my second afternoon at Grandma's, she waved me over from where I was sitting on the front porch, waiting for the mailman. She introduced herself as Roberta and asked me to run to the store for a pack of Newports. When I returned, she waved away the change and proceeded to dazzle me with her exotic life story. She had once been married to a sword swallower, who was now in jail where he belonged. Her second husband, the Canuck, God love him, was dead. Roberta had traveled with the Canuck to both Alaska and Hawaii, and liked Alaska better. She dreamed President Kennedy's assassination the week before it happened. She had been a vegetarian since the day in 1959 when she opened up a can of beef stew and found a baby rat. When Grandma came outside to sweep the porch, she spotted me through Roberta's plate glass window and motioned me home. Back inside, she hit me on the head with a rolled-up newspaper. "Don't you say another word to that piece of garbage," she said, her face flushed in anger. "Don't you listen to another word of her malarkey." "I have a perfect right to make my own friends," I shouted back.
"Not with chippies like that one, you don't."
The center of activity on Pierce Street was Connie's Superette, a little market housed on the bottom floor of a large, asbestos-shingled apartment building. Connie, a fat woman with Lucille Ball red hair, sat behind the counter on a webbed porch chair. She kept a whirring electric fan trained on herself and was careful not to risk breaking her 2-inch fingernails as she grudgingly rang up people's stuff. Connie's nephew, Big Boy, was the butcher. He whistled through his teeth and wore madras shirts and an apron smeared with blood. He looked like Doug McClure on The Virginian. Grandma traded at Connie's because she had never learned to drive a car. But she held a grudge against Big Boy, who had said to her one day in front of a whole storeful of customers, "What'll it be, Tootsie?" When I moved in, she was only too happy to make me her errand girl. Daily, she folded money into my palm and sent me down the street for Tums or cornstarch or prune juice. As I headed out the door, she never failed to remind me to steer clear of both Big Boy and the dirty magazine aisle. The Pizziks lived in the apartment above the Superette. Their twin daughters, Rosalie and Stacia, were the only two girls my age on Pierce Street. They hung out on the upstairs porch, where they danced and giggled and flicked their middle fingers back to neighborhood boys who shouted vulgar remarks up to them. They had a portable record player with a plastic polka dot case and one scratchy record, Big Girls Don't Cry, which they played nonstop at top volume. Both girls wore short shorts and frilly midriff blouses and were Q-tip skinny, although they seemed forever to be eating and drinking something. Their whole day was like a party, a private one. I was both jealous of the twins and petrified of them. Grandma had once thrown a pitcher of water at the girls and called them dirty DPs, when she had caught them ringing her bell and hiding behind her catalpa tree. The Pizzic sisters took an immediate dislike to me, and my daily treks to the store became nightmares. "Hey, kid!" Rosalie shouted down to me on my very first trip to Connie's. Her sister hung over the railing, smirking, and eating from a bag of potato chips. "You stuck up or something? Got a broom up your ass?" Behind her, the Four Seasons wailed in their scratchy falsettos. "Oh, hi," I called up, smiling stiffly. "Gee, that's a good record you're playing. I'm really enjoying it." Already, I could see the three of us walking home from school together, me lending them my 45s. "That's a good record you're playing. I'm really enjoying it," Rosalie mimicked back. Both girls brayed like donkeys. "What's your name?" Stacia shouted down.
"Dolores?"
It came out shaky, like a request.
"Oh," she said. "I thought it was Fucky Face."
Her sister squealed in horrified delight, pulling off a candy wrapper with her teeth and spitting it over the rail at me. Each day it happened again.
"Hi, pukehead,"
one would yell as I approached the store.
"Say hello to all them cooties for us,"
the other would call as I left minutes later with Grandma's groceries. My heart raced. My grandmother's change went sweaty in my fist. I smiled Anne Frank's brave smile and checked my urge to run. Back in the house, I studied my face in the medicine cabinet mirror for clues as to why they hated me. I accepted each of their 100 imagined apologies. One night, I woke up shaky from a dream in which the twins had lured me up to their porch with offers of friendship, and then attempted to hurl me headfirst over the railing.
"What are DPs, anyways?"
I asked Grandma one night. She was at the kitchen table, mumbling her rosary while I dried the dishes. "Displaced persons. People we took in from Europe after the war. You'd think they'd be grateful, wouldn't you?" I understood why they weren't. A displaced person myself. I was not so much grateful to Grandma for her charity as disgusted by her liver spots and quiet belches, the way she could reach into her mouth and, with a gurgle, remove her top teeth. Dolores Price. D.P. We even had the same initials. Still, the Pizzix gave no sign of wanting to meet me on common ground. Jeanette's correspondence was spotty and filled with hurtful proof that her life was proceeding without me. Two ex-friends never wrote back at all. Every Saturday, a letter arrived faithfully from my mother at the state hospital. Her thoughts were hard to follow. In one sentence, she'd be telling me about all the nice people in her art class. In the next, she'd be worrying about the flat iron she was sure had been left on when we closed up our house. "I can smell the heat from here," she insisted. "The house will burn to the ground before anyone recognizes the GD truth." One rainy afternoon, Grandma ran out of eggs. I reluctantly agreed to get her some, reasoning that not even the cold-blooded Pizzix sisters were likely to be out in a downpour. To my relief, their upstairs porch was empty, a burning yellow light bulb the only sign of life. But in the store, rounding the corner by the ice cream freezer, I ran head-on into the twins. My stomach felt the way it does on elevators. It was the first time I had seen them up close, and I studied them in horror. Rosalie was eating onion rings out of a can. Stacia was thumbing through a movie magazine. Both girls had white blonde eyebrows and lots of moles. Stacia's ear was deformed. Two tiny flaps stuck out from the left side of her head as if some powerful vacuum had sucked the rest of her ear back inside her skull. "Oh, hi, Dolores," Rosalie smirked. "You look even uglier when you're wet." I beat it to the front counter. "Hey, Connie," Stacia shouted from the back of the store. "Wait on her quick. She's got bugs." Big Boy was cleaning out his butcher case, holding a necklace of francs in one hand. He stopped and, for the first time that summer, considered my existence. Connie squinted suspiciously, her chubby fingers clicking rapidly over the register keys. My face was hot. I felt tears coming. "I don't have bugs," I croaked. "They just hate my guts." Connie looked at me and then to the twins in aisle one. "Don't you girls touch them magazines if your hands are greasy," was all she said. Stacia and Rosalie approached the counter, giggling and scratching wildly. Stacia held up a large can of Raid. "Help! Get her out of here," she laughed. "Shut up," I said. "You dirty DP, you flipper ear." There was some scratching and hair pulling, and cans of vegetables rattled off the shelves. I can't remember which twin knocked me down. Big Boy and Connie were over us, pulling us apart. "God damn it, they broke one of my good fingernails," Connie bellowed. "Out of the store, the three of yous." In the version of the incident I told Grandma, I hadn't fought back. If I didn't watch it, I reasoned, I'd end up in New Jersey having to be polite to that whore Donna. The following afternoon, while Grandma and I were watching Art Linkletter's house party, a present arrived for me from the hospital. I ripped off the brown paper wrapping, and Grandma and I stared dumbly. It was one of my mother's art therapy paintings. In a clear blue sky, amongst neatly organized clouds, a woman's leg was floating. On the foot was a red high-heeled shoe, and from the thigh grew parakeet green wings, strong ones, of a size that might keep an angel airborne. It was Grandma who first broke the spell. She sat down in her big parlor chair and folded her arms around herself. There were tears in the cracks of skin around her eyes. "I sure love it here in Easterly," I said. It was the only thing I could think of. She reached up and patted my arm. "Never mind about those foolish DP girls," she said.
You just stay in the house with decent people like us.
She nodded her head toward the TV to include Art Linkletter. Up in my room, I spread all of Ma's letters on the bed, trying to find some trace of sanity in her penmanship. Then I wedged the painting behind the dresser. In August, Grandma enrolled me in the 7th grade class at my mother's old school, St. Anthony's. I had heard horror stories about parochial schools. Jeanette Nord's cousin knew someone who'd been whacked so often in the head with her own arithmetic book that she'd suffered brain damage and permanent baldness, according to Jeanette. Still, I was itchy to meet kids my own age. Grandma said rough girls like the Pizziks attended public school. It was Ingrid Bergman who finally won me over. Her sad, brave death in the Bells of St. Mary's on Channel 10 Sunday Matinee Theater shot straight to my heart. We registered the next day. On the first day of school, Grandma yanked repeatedly at the waist of my plaid uniform and handed me a thermos of grape Xerax and an egg salad sandwich she said she hoped wouldn't go bad by noon. Walking along Pierce Street, I studied myself in the storefront windows. "Here is a girl who is pretty in a quiet way," I told myself. "I bet she's had a very sad life." In the schoolyard, I leaned against the cool brick building and rigged a tight smile on my face to show everyone how perfectly happy I was not to have anyone to talk to. When a dodgeball thunked me in the shoulder, I mistook it for an invitation of friendship. But two boys half my height were waving impatiently, yelling, "Hey, kid!" I picked up the ball and, in mid-throw, saw something that sucked the breath out of me. Leaning against a cyclone fence, elbowing a small cluster of shrieky girls, were Stacia and Rosalie Pizzik, wearing plaid woolen uniforms identical to my own. Things began to move too fast. A bell blared. Nuns appeared, clapping their hands and calling orders. Neither Pizzik had spotted me. I trailed into the building a safe distance behind them. The corridor smelled of fresh paint and had creaky floors. The dim green walls were lined with framed pictures of past graduating classes, and despite my panic, I tried to locate my mother's portrait as I passed. Up ahead, Stacia took a turn down another corridor behind the 6th grade nun. But Rosalie, apparently the smarter of the two, ambled amidst the 7th grade group with the lethal cool of a mountain lion. Our classroom was on the 2nd floor at the top of the stairs. Outside the door, on a gray pedestal, was a plaster statue of the Blessed Virgin, her arms extended. I tramped in behind the others, addressing an emergency prayer to the statue that she'd help me discover some clever way to dodge Rosalie Pizzik for the next 180 school days. Luckily, I was assigned the last desk in the row next to the windows. Just outside was the fire escape. If worse came to worst, I thought. Our teacher, Miss Lily, was new to the school, like me. She was a tall, frail woman and had dry, dusty-looking hair that had been teased up in front and more or less forgotten in back. She spent a large portion of the morning opening desk drawers and slamming them shut again in little bursts of temper she quickly covered over with a brief, squinty smile. I studied Miss Lily intensely, with shriveling confidence in her ability to keep me safe from Rosalie. The fire escape looked rusty and rickety. I imagined it pulling away from the building against my weight, Rosalie laughing at the window as I fell in an arc toward the blacktop. By late morning, each of us had been issued a pile of mildewy-smelling textbooks. Adventures in World History, Arithmetic for Modern Youth, Science and Health for Catholic School Children, and a religious text illustrated with black and white photos of the same boy and girl participating in a variety of holy activities. They were joyous or solemn, as the event demanded, and both were stupidly old-fashioned looking.
I wondered if, by some odd quirk, I hadn't been assigned the exact same book my mother had used. I took an immediate dislike to the boy and girl in the pictures. Sunny, wholesome, goody-goody types. The kind of kid Grandma favored. It was she who had gotten me into this, the old bag. At lunchtime, I followed the others down to the maze of formica tables and metal folding chairs in the basement of the school. The Pizik twins, reunited, lunched from a large cellophane bag of cheese popcorn. Their friends began to stretch and gawk at me, and the noisy lunchroom rang with whoops of laughter aimed in my direction. "Who?" someone yelled, rising from her seat for a better look. "That thing?" I sat down at a table with two overweight younger girls involved in a conversation about horses. They snuck nervous glances at me and then stopped talking. "I'm new at this school," I said, unscrewing the top of my thermos. "I'm in seventh." Both girls shoved their faces into their sandwiches and chewed uneasily. A boy tapped me on the arm. "She wants you," he said, pointing to one of the old lady cafeteria workers. But when I walked up to her, she told me to hurry on if I was just going to stand there and not buy anything. I returned to my seat. My thermos had been tipped over and grape drink was splattering onto the floor. My sandwich was a soggy, purple-stained mess. From the corner of my eye, I could see the Pizziks and their friends bending and stretching. Stacia's face was pressed against the tabletop and she was snorting. The two girls at my table stared open-faced. "What are you looking at, fatty?" I snapped at one of them. Miss Lily came back from lunch smelling like cigarettes. I mouthed the magic word, cramps, and she handed me the hall pass. Outside the classroom, I lingered for a moment at the statue of Mary, intending to let her in on what Rosalie had done to me. "Hail Mary, full of grace," I whispered, then stopped. Her nose was chipped, and her sky-blue eyes stared out at nothing. She was unaware of the serpent curling at her feet. Down in the main corridor, I paused at the long rows of framed pictures, St. Anthony's graduates of the last 40 years. I located my mother in the bottom row of the brown-tinted portraits of the class of 1944. Her dark, frizzy hair was parted in the middle and held tight to each side with oval barrettes. Her eyes looked slightly away from the camera, and she wore an expression of quiet seriousness. I was astonished that she looked more like an old-fashioned me than she did my mother. The corridor was cool and peaceful. "Hi," I said aloud. The sound of my voice set my heart thumping, but I continued. "You're divorced, you know. You have a daughter. I'm her." For homework, Miss Lily had assigned us a chapter on religion and one on Mesopotamia. My bedroom was hot, so I set up the table fan from the kitchen and aimed the breeze at my face. "Dear Daddy," I wrote on a fresh piece of loose-leaf paper, "I know for a fact that Mommy still loves you very much. We both miss you more than I can say. I think I may be coming down with stomach cancer. I just have this feeling." Then I gouged out the words with deep, dark pencil marks that dented several of the pages beneath it. "North of what is now the region of the Persian Gulf, a civilization nearly as advanced as Egypt's began to flower, with soil enriched by the rivers Euphrates and Tigris." I stared at the whirring fan, trying to make out the shape of the blades in the blue-gray blur. I moved a finger closer and closer, watching it shake. "They'll find me in a pool of blood. Daddy will hate himself for the rest of his life. Rosalie Pizik will have a nervous breakdown."
The Sumerians flourished on the flat, fertile land made rich from the alluvium of the two rivers. Their contributions to civilization... I shifted the breeze away from me, and the shiny pages of my opened religion book began to turn by themselves. I watched the goody-goody girl and boy in the textbook photos. "I hate your guts," I told them. Suddenly, the book fluttered open to page 232. A previous user, some greasy boy with dirt-caked fingernails, no doubt, had altered the photo of the model students. In the picture, the two counterparts were walking down the steps of a school that looked something like St. Anthony's, smiling radiantly at each other. Both of their midsections had been erased white. The ideal girl was wearing an inverted triangle of loopy pubic hair and two mismatched breasts that looked like garnished cupcakes. The ideal boy's hoo-hoo was a periscope. Two makeshift cartoon bubbles floated above their heads. "How about some sex? Intercourse?" "That means fucking," the girl said, beaming brightly. "Okay," the boy replied, his enthusiasm measured in exclamation marks. The Sumerians flourished on the flat, fertile land made rich from the alluvium of the two rivers. Their contributions... In the next hour, I drank two large glasses of ice water, slid my eyes repeatedly over the same paragraph in my history book, stuck my entire face 1 inch away from the fan, and covered the front and back of my loose leaf with Richard Chamberlain's name and birthday in ornate block lettering. None of it worked. Whenever I'd turn back to page 232, reasoning I'd imagined the whole thing, there they'd still be. The next day at school, Miss Lily was wearing an ankle-length paisley skirt and a tight turtleneck shirt that let you see the entire outline of her bra. Her hair was yanked back tightly and crowned with a bun the size of a small hamburger patty. She looked nothing like she had the day before. I wondered if she might have a split personality like Margot on Search for Tomorrow. If she might even be crazy like my mother. If the whole world wasn't crazy. All morning long, I kept turning against my better judgment to page 232, wanting over and over to verify its secret existence. On Wednesday morning, Miss Lily smiled mysteriously and said she had a surprise for us. "Popsicles," someone guessed. She ignored this and pulled at the two roll-down maps that hung over the blackboard. The entire board area was filled with Miss Lily's beautiful penmanship. She had come to school a half hour early, she said, to copy down a poem for us, Ode on a Grecian Urn. She explained she was something of an expert on this poem, having written in college a paper on it that ran to 23 typed pages.
"Now, if you will be still and concentrate very hard, I think you'll appreciate the cadences as I read aloud. After I finish, we'll discuss its beautiful meaning." She began in a low, moaning voice and seemed almost immediately to fall into a trance. In her hand, she held a fresh stick of chalk, which she swung back and forth as she read, like Mitch Miller. Rosalie Pizik looked back at the rest of us and pointed to herself. I knew Miss Lily was in trouble. Rosalie raised her forearm to her lips, her cheeks puffed out, and she let loose an amazing reproduction of a fart, the kind I hadn't heard since my father's move to Tenafly. The class burst into nervous laughter. Miss Lily stopped, as if someone had doused her with ice water. Her face contorted in several odd ways, and she walked to the board and began erasing away Ode on a Grecian Urn with the swooping strokes of defeat, going over and over the same area until I realized she was crying. Rosalie sat sideways in her chair, shaking from the laughter she was swallowing. I imagined myself drawing a gun from my desk, taking aim, and killing her without so much as a quiver. My Mesopotamia essay was a dismal failure. With a tired sigh, Miss Lily suggested I skip lunchtime recess and revise it, little knowing the reward she was giving me.
When you finish, just put it on my desk and join the rest of us next door at church for seventh grade confession. Did you remember to bring your mantilla?
I sat listening to her sandals clack down the corridor. One of the fluorescent lights made a funny sputtering noise, which the strange silence of the empty classroom amplified. I tiptoed to the front and sat down on Miss Lily's chair. I hadn't planned it. I looked out at the rows of empty desks and was flooded with sympathy for Miss Lily. There was a silver thermos on her desk and several notices and reminders from Sister Margaret Francis, the principal. When I picked up the battered poetry book, it opened automatically to Ode on a Grecian Urn. The print was underlined and circled, and everywhere on the page were little arrows and notations, each ending in an exclamation point. Her straw purse was behind her desk. I picked it up and reached inside. Watching the classroom door, I pulled out her car keys, a pack of Winston's, and a brown plastic vial of pills. The label read, "Sandra Lily, take one at bedtime when needed. No refills." There was a $5 bill in her wallet, three quarters, and some 7-cent stamps. Sandwiched inside the worn, scratchy cellophane windows were her pictures. A blonde woman with a bubble-top hairdo. An elderly couple standing in front of a fancy cake. And a black-and-white shot of Miss Lily and some man at the beach. Miss Lily's hair was wet and stringy, and her bathing suit straps were down. The man wore sunglasses and had a flabby waist. I banished him from the picture and imagined Big Boy from the Superette instead. They were in the sand, Big Boy and Miss Lily, kissing and kissing. No one else was around. They were rubbing against each other. Then suddenly, they were both naked. When I looked up, I saw Rosalie's red vinyl notebook. My plan presented itself to me fully developed, like a gift from God. I put Miss Lily's things back in her purse. I walked over to Rosalie's desk and picked up her religion book. Back at my own desk, I made the exchange, then placed my book amongst Rosalie's things. Miss Lily smiled at me when I slid into the girls' pew. I smiled back, feeling strangely confident. Inside the confessional, I waited for Father Dubtolsky to slide open his window. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 3 weeks since my last confession. These are my sins." I told him I had been disrespectful to my grandmother and had sworn under my breath on 11 different occasions. Then, in the most humble voice I could manufacture, I confessed how I had sat wickedly by while I watched my good friend Rosalie Pizik deface her religion book with a filthy, immoral picture. I listened, somewhat amazed, to the treacherous catch in my voice. "She's really okay, Father. I'm sure she didn't even mean to do it. For these and all the sins of my past life, I am heartily sorry." For my penance, Father Dubtolsky gave me 10 Hail Marys, something that struck me as a reasonable punishment for an accomplice, a mere bridesmaid in crime. I knelt and prayed, not for forgiveness, but for the accuracy of my assumption, that the sanctity of the confessional applied more to murderers than kids. Back in class, Miss Lily was talking about apostrophes when Sister Margaret Francis appeared at the door. "Miss Lily," she said in a sweet voice, "we'll be doing a seventh grade textbook inspection." Miss Lily looked bewildered. "Will this be next week?" she asked. "This will be today. This will be right now." Outside, after school, Stacia milled around impatiently. You seen Rosalie? She kept asking everyone. You seen Rosalie?
Rosalie Pizik was absent on Thursday, but word had gotten around about what she'd done. So had the news of her punishment, which broke all school records for its severity. Every afternoon until Thanksgiving vacation, Sister Margaret Frances would make an X on the blackboard. Rosalie would stand for one-hour sessions with her nose affixed to the intersection. I walked home from school that afternoon so free of burden that my steps felt like a preliminary to flight, as if at any next moment I might be airborne. Power had made me hungry, and I was already eating out of the bag of potato chips as Connie rang up my sale. Grandma watched as I poked my finger into the corners of the bag for salt and crumbs, then ate two of the tapioca pudding she'd made for supper.
"My gracious, school certainly gives you an appetite," she observed.
"It's a free country," I said, "Granny babes." That night, up in my room, I pulled Ma's flying leg out from behind the dresser and saw, for the first time, that it was beautiful. I hung it above my bed,